on Senate Joint Memorial Number 3. Senator Gordley. Senator Brown, if you join in here, real good.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, good. And members of the committee.
How are you this afternoon?
Oh, just fine. It's a wonderful spring day out there, truly. If you open the blinds, you'll find that out.
The blinds. I can do that. You know, the only bad thing I love is I'm really bothered by what's happening right now in Littleton, Colorado.
I understand. It's
a sad, sad situation.
I
think it bothers me as a person, as a parent, as an educator. It's just frightening when you think of what's going to happen. Spencer Shields always sheds light on things.
I'm sure.
We truly share your sentiments this afternoon, Mr. Chair. Senator Brown and I were also commenting on the tragic events in Colorado, and there's just no way to prepare ourselves for this kind of thing happening in our communities, and we can only recommit ourselves to being vigilant to do all that we can to prevent these things from happening to our children.
Very sad.
Mr. Chair, on behalf of Senator Brown, we thank you for this opportunity to hold an informational hearing on Senate Joint Memorial 3. For the record, my name is Avelle Gordley. I represent Senate District 10 in Portland. And before I begin my prepared remarks, Mr. Chair, I do want to note the importance of our support for those troops that are now stationed in harm's way in Europe and around the world. And with that said, and again, without minimizing support for our troops abroad, the federal budget emphasis on military spending, which is what we are here to focus on this afternoon, continues to strangle our national and state capabilities to address domestic needs, from public safety to economic development, from human services to public education, and from housing to health care. Nonprofit organizations, churches and synagogues, foundations and state agencies have been providing critical services for years and continue to be overburdened. These public and private efforts are collectively unable to fully address citizen needs without additional domestic funding. Increasingly, states are assuming the responsibility, if not the funding, needed to leverage and address critical needs of its residents. And in our own state, Mr. Chair, we're often talking about the critical needs of women and children. Senate Joint Memorial 3 urges Congress to redirect sufficient funds from the military budget to states to meet those critical needs of rebuilding communities and our inner cities, repairing schools, educating children, eliminating hunger, providing housing, improving transportation, protecting the environment, and obtaining a decent level of health care and safety for all of our citizens. This is indeed our national security. Our nation's health and security is dependent upon the well-being of its citizens, not just the protection of its borders and interests abroad. The states are in the advantageous role of understanding the needs of its residents, knowing the gaps in services, and how best to leverage public and private efforts to meet the local needs. I have attached to my testimony several handouts regarding the fiscal year 2000 discretionary budget. What you will see is that year after year, our national defense competes with domestic program spending for taxpayer dollars. We need to openly discuss the priorities for those taxpayer dollars and openly discuss our state responsibility for its revenue. I do appreciate, Mr. Chair, your willingness to hear the argument. I look forward to future discussions, formal and informal. Thank you and the committee for your attention. And now I would like to defer to my colleague, Senator Kate Brown, for additional remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7 in Portland. And I'd also like to recognize my good friend, Sarah Gordley, for taking the lead on this issue. I really appreciate her hard work, and I know her staff's hard work on this as well. I just have a few remarks I'd like to make in support of SJM 3, and again, thanks for giving us the time for a hearing. As budgetary patterns grow and shift, federal, state, and local emphasis fluctuates. We in Oregon have seen economic upturn, and yet we're still struggling with our own needs to fund important state services. Senate Joint Memorial 3 asks our counterparts in national government to meet the domestic need in America at a rate more in accordance with our post-Cold War international environment. The materials that we provided illustrate the impact to Oregon of current military funding levels. It's time for a change in the formula. Just want to share a brief statement. The Cold War is over, but the United States still gives the Pentagon more money than it asked for, makes hundreds of exotic, expensive weapon systems, exports more arms than anyone else in the world, spends billions on nuclear weapons, accounts for 41% of the world's military expenditures, despite having only 5% of the world's population. And, of course, we lag behind many of the other industrial nations in our human services, our health, and our education. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and I encourage your support of SJM 3.
Thank you very much, Senators. I appreciate you folks being here this afternoon. Thank you. Any questions for them? Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Kerrigan? Mr. Kerrigan, are you here? Are you? We have your written testimony. Would you like to have us submit that for the record? Okay, we'll do that. We'll see. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Kerrigan, for coming in. Okay. We close the informational meeting and going to go to, going to move the order here and move up to Senate Bill 913. A work session on 9/13.
We have a discussion of what it is and what it does.
Yes, why don't you explain?
Sure, Duncan, members of the committee. Senate Bill 913 would require the educational institutions establish test sheltered annuities at the request of five or more employees of that institution. And those test sheltered annuities would go to whatever company those five employees choose. We've been requested by the Chair of Rules and Elections to send this to his committee so that they could provide it with a public hearing. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to do that in our committee.
Any other discussion on this?
Sure. Why don't we have time?
Chair Duncan, Senator Tro, we have some deadlines that we're working with, and we have a number of bills that we'd like to get to.
I guess who's there at least than we are.
Maybe we should add this to this one day.
We
should be on the brief on this one.
We have been requested to Senator Tro.
I'm sorry, I should have, I didn't do my...
I will get send it to Senator Lynn if he wants to move it. I don't like this bill particularly, and I don't want to send it anywhere. I'd like it to stay here, and we could have a hearing on it, as far as I'm concerned. If you want to have a hearing, or it could languish. It's not a bill that I'm fond
of. Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Is this kind of a work session?
Yeah, it is a work session.
Could I ask Senator Trill, why he doesn't like the bill. I don't know anything about the subject. I'm just trying to gather information.
You must have held a hearing, didn't you? No, we didn't. No, we never did have a hearing.
Well, it's requiring an educational institution to do something that my guess is that they could do probably if they wanted to. I don't know anything about the Oregon Society for the International Certified Financial Planners, but the International Association of Financial Planners. I guess I would like to know what they're about. Do you know anything about
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, my understanding is that we did have a request from American Express Financial Services to have a public hearing on this bill, and I think it would be to their advantage to have something like this enacted, because at the request of those five members of the educational institution, the educational institution would have to set up the annuity program in a company of their choice.
I guess I had said at one point we didn't. It was one
that was people requested, and then they have to do it.
And this is any educational institution.
Any education. Education. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just sounds like a little bit of a self-interested legislation.
I'm not inspired, but it's...
Anybody here who is promoting this thing?
Is the group represented? They're not here. They did come to see me, and I wasn't particularly interested. They said, well, they had a committee that would hear it, would we refer it? And I said, fine, if somebody else wants to do it, but I wasn't going to be hearing it in here.
Did you have a public hearing?
No, we did not.
How could we have a work session with that?
Well, the work session was just to move it.
Oh, okay.
To move it.
Where do they want to move it to?
Okay, the rules.
Well, I think they probably want it.
Okay. Which one? I don't have it on here.
Sorry about our confusion. It's a bit of...
Oh, then it's an old one. You probably have a new one.
Okay.
I'm not...
I'm not hearing any interest on the committee's part. Senator Lamb, do you have
enough? If they want to move to a roof, that I don't have any objection to it. You know, they might look it up. If they don't like it, they can see it. If they like it, they might bring it up. Without knowing, I don't want to either object or support it at this point. Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Well, I'd make the motion if you want to do it.
All right.
I mean, I don't want to hold a bill that somebody else wants to have time for. Unless you want it.
Yeah.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Please keep it as the vote. Okay. Then we're going to get organized here. Just a few minutes, folks.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 913 be reported out without recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules and Elections.
Any discussion?
No discussion.
All right. The motion is to report out Senate Bill 913 without recommendation as to passage, and that the bill will be referred to the Committee on Rules and Elections. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Lynn?
Aye.
Senator Hammond?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
No.
Senator Trump?
No.
Senator Duncan?
I'll say aye. It will be referred to Rules and Elections. Senate Bill 913. All right. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1001. Marjorie?
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1001 comes to you at the request of the Ben McKeon School District, and it requires that an insurer that insures a public body, should disclose claims experience.
Okay, Scott Murchie. Hello there, Scott. Come on up. You do live more than 100 miles from Salem, too. I'll vouch for that. Good afternoon, Scott. It's good to have you here. Would you identify yourself for the record?
You bet. I'm Scott Murchie, superintendent of the Ben McKeon School District, and I really thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today on the contents of Senate Bill 1001 that is now before you. Senator Duncan and members of the General Government Committee, employee benefits and the rising cost of providing a benefit package to employees has been a topic of research and study for the school boards of Central Oregon over the past 5 years. Public bodies have heard repeatedly over the past 10 years that the cost of doing business must be evaluated and measures taken to ensure the best and most efficient product is obtained for the dollar spent. There is evidence that the...
Excuse me just a minute. For those of you who have been following what's been going on in the news, two of the suspects are dead, suicide, it appears. And the report we have right now, there are at least 20 to 25 fatalities. This is an estimate, no confirmation at this point. I'm sorry, I asked them to give me a report, and I...
Okay.
I just need a 5 minute recess, okay? This is...
and trust that you'll read that. I'm going to depart from going through that.
Why don't you brief us
word for word,
dealing with your after shot?
Basically, the issue is that we're not upset with necessarily any particular entity in the insurance industry with our bill. What we're asking for is the release of experience data that carriers that provide benefit packages for school districts be required to release the data they have to the school districts for decision making. I point out that over the last 5 years, we've taken a real hard look at our insurance benefit package. And in Central Oregon school districts, which includes six, we did a feasibility study after the passage of Senate Bill 867, which amended the Oregon Revised Statutes last session to include public school districts as an entity that could consider self-insurance as an option. Our feasibility study indicates that of the $12.5 million that was spent by the six Central Oregon school districts for fringe benefit packages, that with the data that we could obtain on experience ratings for those six districts, that we could realize the savings up to $500,000 in the worst case scenario and up to $2 million in the best case scenario with the projected numbers that we have. In a time where the cost of doing business is under tremendous scrutiny, there's plenty of evidence that the legislature has commissioned several studies for the cost of doing business in the public education arena in the last few years, that if, in fact, school districts are expected, and I think they should be, to analyze, are they getting the best bang for the buck that they're spending, that as we consider self-insurance as an option, we need to have the best available data in order to make sure that the decision that we're making is the best one for that public body. And without the release of experience data by the carriers that provide the services, it's very, very difficult. I can't think of a business in Oregon or anywhere else that would make a decision hinging on a $12.5 million premium if they didn't have the very best data available. What we're asking for is the support of Senate Bill 1001, which would require any carrier of a health insurance package for a school district to release their data to the school district so the school district may then analyze the data for themselves and make a business decision that they believe is in the best interest of its entity. We believe that whether $500,000 savings or $2 million savings, there's a number of teachers that could be hired to reduce class sizes. We could purchase additional instructional materials, or we could address staff development, which is in short funds throughout the state right now. We're just asking for more opportunity to have data to make better decisions. With that, I will make my comments brief today, and thank you for the opportunity to testify for you. And the news of Colorado is heavy on all of our hearts right now.
Questions for Ms. Scott?
Well, I have a lot.
Sure.
Pick
the real...
Are we going to work the bill?
We'll see.
If we, I might have to walk. If you want to work it, I'll vote for it. Do we have a vote? Are there people to testify?
Yeah, there's a list to testify, too, yeah.
Okay, I'll just listen and then...
Go ahead and ask your question. If you want to.
I'm going to stay if you want.
Well, I just want to, because isn't this something that the school teachers, OEA, has already figured out? And they insure them all, and then they bill the district for so much, and then they can buy it cheaper to keep the difference or something?
Well, they will not release our experience data to us, and they do keep experience data on individual districts. We cannot, when we receive a premium increase notice from that carrier, all we get is the percentage increase. We do not get the data that supports that. And what we're asking for is we want the experience data. If, in fact, a carrier that's insuring a school district, if their experience claims at 100%, where every dollar going is being spent on claim,
obviously there's justification for a premium increase.
Okay, I have a question.
Yes.
Is it in their contract that they shall, you give them the money and they buy their own insurance through OEA?
In our particular district, the district has agreed with the teachers to have OEA insurance at the bargaining table. And the district pays the premium of $411 per employee.
So that was yes.
The answer is yes, but we still should have the experience data that justifies the amount of money that's going out of the general fund to pay for those premiums. And we cannot get that.
Well, but my question is this, that if I was starting up a big company, why would I have to have the experience data of all these people that I wanted to hire? Why can't you just start out from scratch, take it out of your negotiated contract, say, we will self-insure this whole consortium? Why do you have to have this information? Because obviously you could provide it cheaper, like you say, get more teachers in the class.
Based on the projections that we've made, the indication is yes, that we can do it cheaper. All we're asking for is to substantiate our projections with accurate data. And I believe a better business decision could be made with accurate data than just the projection that we've made.
Okay, but one more question.
Sure.
That there is nothing in the law right now that forbids you from taking it out of the contract next time you negotiate, say we're going to do this ourselves. Because how big is OEA? I heard it was $29 billion.
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay.
I do know that all the contract has in our district is names the carrier in the current contract. So we can't arbitrarily just go self-insure. It has to be negotiated with the body that would be a decision that we would do. Right now, we do have the wherewithal with our administrators and our classified people in our district to do that.
Stephen, did you want to testify on this? Did you guys come together? Why don't you come on up here at the same time? Right. Identify yourself, too, for this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Herron. I'm a staff attorney for the ESD, Education Service District, in Redmond, Oregon. And Bend Lapine School District is one of our ESD component districts. Actually, I have written a testimony. I think I was supposed to present it.
Okay, give it to the director. If you could kind of highlight that, this might be helpful to us. Just for everyone's information, we do have, we're down to the last days of introduction of bills, so I'm going to be moving rather rapidly today, and most likely we'll be holding a public hearing in most cases and not work session, because I want to get through the things and I can come back later. Once we've had the hearing, I can come back, but I can't hold a public hearing later. Okay, Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Frankly, last session, Senate Bill 867 allowed school districts to explore this issue of self-funded insurance option. It was previously an option for other governmental entities, but the bill allowed school districts to do that. And the Central Oregon school districts have expressed an interest in exploring that, determining what the possibilities are, what the options are, what the configurations might look like, and whether or not there's any cost savings. And essentially, Senate Bill 1001 is a prerequisite bill to, for all practical purposes, effectuating Senate Bill 867. And the reason is, to use an illustration, there's nothing in the law that prohibits, for example, me from going out and starting up a hamburger chain. And there's nothing that prohibits me from saying, I'm going to go ahead and charge $2.99 for a hamburger, a soft drink, and fries, because that's what an industry standard might look like. If I was to do that without making any effort or without being allowed to gather any data as to what my costs would be, as to what my profit margin might look like, that would be a foolish business decision. The bottom line is, all of us know that before making business decisions, folks go out and gather data, determine what the costs are, determine what the profit margins are, determine what the instance like this, what the savings, potential savings might be, in order to determine whether it's worth the effort. When the Central Oregon School District commissioned a study, a feasibility study of the self-insurance option, one of the difficulties we discovered is that we were only provided approximately one-third of the experience data, claims experience data, of our component district's workforces. To be able to make determinations of whether or not it's feasible, to be able to determine whether or not there's going to be savings, how much those savings might be, without knowing what the claims experience numbers look like, is very, very difficult. So Senate Bill 1001, in essence, would require insurance companies that are making money by insuring public entity workforces to disclose the experience data. It's our experience data. It's our workforce experience data, and it is absolutely reasonable that we be allowed to know what the experience data looks like. The effect of 1001 is actually twofold, ultimately. The effect of 1001 is that for public entities exploring self-insurance options, they will be able to analyze the feasibility and the potential savings with much more particularity and much less speculation. But a second effect, frankly, of 1001 will be that districts will be able to, or excuse me, public entities generally, but our interest obviously is in school districts, will be able to get a particularized idea of how much markup is being built into the premium. If we're able to evaluate the claims experience data, we'll be able to determine how much profit is being generated. I mean, that's really what the savings numbers are that we're looking to find out. How much we can save is how much profit is being skimmed off the claims experience costs. So I would assert that a second effect of 1001 will be to encourage competition among traditional private insurers and for those public entities that continue to that don't go the self-insurance route, but continue to acquire insurance through private insurance companies, it will encourage those companies to bid competitively, and it'll create an accountability for how much of the dollar is claims experience-based and how much of the dollar is profit, and it will allow our public entities to be able to better analyze and evaluate the bids being given to them and to pick the bids that the companies are determining, the responsible companies are determining that their margin doesn't need to be as big. I would assert that companies that have confidence in the quality of their product and their service and so forth, and who have confidence that their products are properly priced, reasonably priced, won't be intimidated by this bill. Frankly, they'll be able to say, look, this is how much markup there is. We think that's reasonable given the service that we provide, and take it or leave it. I would assert that if a company is a little bit less comfortable with sunshine, there's a reason for that. Another potential objection that the committee might hear would be that this is cumbersome or expensive, or this is something we can't do readily or easily. I would assert that that's not correct. Number one, when we did the feasibility study, we did have 37% accuracy of our claim experience data, which came from one particular insurance company that was willing to release that to us. So at least one company not only was able to, but was willing to release that claim experience data to us. Secondly, it's very, very difficult to believe that insurance companies are not analyzing this data themselves in determining what the risk levels are, what the premium levels ought to be set at, and so forth. So it would seem to me that an argument that this is not gatherable is a bit of a smokescreen or a disingenuous argument, because certainly this data is utilized by the companies themselves in analyzing the risks in the premium rates.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Questions, Senator Cole?
If there is a cost involved to the insurance company in doing this, should the requester of the information pay the cost?
I guess the difficulty of that question it depends on who determines what the cost is and what the parameters are set for how that determination is made. Let me take a step back and just note, there are folks who provide insurance companies to, insurance coverage to public entities who have very strong vested economic interests in these issues. And in the course of our exploration of the possibility of self-insurance in the Central Oregon School District Consortium, we've met quite a bit of resistance, frankly. And so unless there were very, very specific parameters on what constituted cost,
if they might run
that, it would be a way of backdooring and then showing off the information. If you make the cost of gathering the information prohibitive, you've eliminated the competition.
Senator, I would respond by saying that there is no free lunch. If there was a reasonable fee for obtaining the data, I would be more than happy to pay a fee so I could take a look at our experience data.
The bill doesn't say that, anything about cost, so it might be that if you wanted to put that in, reasonable cost, that might help to get it done, because I think there would be some cost.
Mm-hmm. If I were, I'm sure you're dealing with private insurance companies, and if I were dealing with them, I don't think it's any of your business what the data is, and I think that there's actuaries out there, so you could estimate and go into business. I think what you need to do is, what seems to me, and I have the right to be wrong, is that you have some board members who are married to educators, and they're just throwing up roadblocks. Because you can make a business decision and look at the actuaries that are out there, and all the age group of your people and all that, and this is, might be just an excuse. Now, we might consider it if we knew just this, but I mean, I'm not really that much in the education community, and I know OEA makes a bundle off the insurance schemes.
Senator, we have done that. We have our projected data. It's just, again, that I think that in order for me to make assurances to the board and to our public that the dollars are being spent in the most effective and cost-efficient way, it would be nice to be able to deliver the data with that.
Sure, but it's their business.
I understand.
Yeah.
Other questions?
Yes,
Senator.
I'm not expert on this issue, but some insurance company, when you're asking information, that's very sensitive information you are asking. If I give you one example, that I think the Burger King hamburger company took the McDonald's to the court and through that court process, they were able to find out all the McDonald's top secret issues, how much it costs, how they run. With that information, they were able to bring the shareholder company successfully hiding against the McDonald's. They have been very successful because they got the secret from the McDonald's company. This is not just information requesting. You are asking that the top, most important information from the company. I'm sure if I'm running the company, I'm reluctant to give out any information you request. It is not just a public record issue. It is a company's a policy issue. They're competing with many other different companies. And so we need to look at carefully how it's going to affect in the future when we test this year.
Okay. Other questions?
That's my just comment.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think we'll move on. Chris Dudley. All right. Will Piggy be, are you testifying together to us all by chance?
If Peggy would like to join me up here, it's fine.
Thank you, Peggy. Why don't you come on?
That helps your process.
Chair,
I'm Chris Bradley. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon School Boards Association, 1201 Court Street Northeast, Salem, Oregon. And as the Executive Director, I wear a couple of hats, one of which is I'm the Administrator of the Oregon School Boards Association Insurance Trust. And that insurance trust was created 25 years ago or so in order to help school districts come together and jointly purchase insurance coverages, and the trust makes those programs available to districts if they want to take advantage of them. We're not exclusive by any means, but we do have a pretty good product out there and has a long historic record of good product. We have two trusts, one's in the property casualty field, and that's property insurance, liability, etc. benefits field. And Senate Bill 1001, although laudable in goal, may have some unintended effects that you should be aware of. If you have a truly pooled risk pool for an insurance coverage,
which we do. We've got about 170 districts that have some piece of their insurance for employees with us. That trust is blind to the loss ratio of that particular district. So if you've got a really bad experience over here, you get in there for the same price as this person has a really good experience over here. And some of the frustration that people from Central Oregon may feel is in, if any of them have the coverages through our Blue Cross facility, we do not provide individual district experience ratios because we don't collect them and we don't bill them on that basis. We don't charge them on that basis. So if you have a truly pooled rate, which we've had for a long period of time, then districts come into that and go out of that based on that total pooled experience. And the problem with the proposal you got here is, one, it's worded kind of broadly because it says the body shall disclose annual the insurance, an insurer that issues insurance to a public body mm-hmm. shall disclose annually to the public body any information about the insurer's claims experience that the public body requests. That means whatever they ask for, you got to give them, whether you collect it that way or not. I mean, that's pretty broad. Our concern about this is that it's literally written, any particular school district who's been a long-time member of our trust decides they'd like to go out and explore self-insurance, then they can get from our trust experience rating that it does not now collect, nor does it use in determining what the premiums will do for all districts in that trust. They are in there unidentifiable, like a drop of water in a pool. We don't want to identify them that way. We don't want to treat them as if they're a bad loss person or a good loss person. We want it to be a true pool. I believe that worded the way this is, you will create a death spiral for the true pooled risk arrangements here for local governments. Cities have them, school districts have them, and special districts have them. I think the counties have them. And so I think you better go very carefully here. If what the district wanted were the experience rates on which we base their premium, which is the whole pool's rate, we can give that, and it is available. You can see how much the administrative cost is. You can see how much premiums relate to actual losses. You can see the basis on which that total pool premium is determined. But literally, as this is worded, this would allow the union or some other private insurer or some consultant to simply cherry-pick our pool and take the best people out at that particular time, leave us with a worst experience rate, increase the rates for the other 160 school districts. Then when these guys go in the bucket and have a bad experience, they want to come back in the pool again, then again raising our risk. And so for the long term, this is not a very good idea the way it's worded. If it's a good public policy to tell a pool arrangement, you need to tell any member of your pool the loss information on which you base their premium change, that's a different question, and I think you can get that and you'd be happy to provide that. But the way this is written, I think it's an unintended result, but I think the way this is written, it would put any of the pooling arrangements in real jeopardy.
Okay. Peggy?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm taking on a hat that I used to wear as the administrator of the League of Oregon Cities Employee Benefit Services Trust, and I also served as a consultant to the Association of Oregon Counties Trust. And since Noel Klein, who's the executive director of these programs, now cannot be here, he asked if I would come in and oppose this measure. Chris did a great job of outlining the kind of risk considerations. In the case of the cities, this is exacerbated in that most of the cities that participate in the league's program have fewer than 25 employees, and in fact, most of them have fewer than 10. So when you take a look at the potential volatility for claims experience from one year to the next, you have a much heightened possibility of instability in the claims experience. And what happens, of course, is that somebody would take a look at their claims data and decide that they would do better off someplace else and then come back in a couple of years. And it only takes one cancer surgery, one auto accident sort of situation to skew their data. In both the cities and the counties case, they have striven heavily over the years to moderate the claims or the rate increases, and in fact have subsidized from their reserves the premiums that are paid by those entities. And because of the large group that they have, the administrative experience that is actually charged is much lower than what they would be able to get if they went out and actually bought a plan on their own. And the thing that is important to realize about this is that the essence of the bill really goes to setting up a self-insured program. Everybody acknowledges that these entities now can go out and get coverage through another carrier. The focus of this really deals with the self-insured plan. And the thing that is interesting in the Central Oregon situation, at least as I have understood it, they're talking about setting up a consortium sort of program, and they want to sort of figure out what would be the appropriate rate. But the thing that is interesting about the self-insured statute that allows for jointly self-insured entities, that even if they had this information to do the collective rating, the statute specifically says that each public body that is participating in a jointly self-insured program is only liable for its own employees' claims cost. So if it turns out, particularly in this case, that one of these consortiums ran into difficulty, the way the statute presently reads, these individuals would not spread their risk among all of the participants in the plan. So the group that was having the difficulty, that had the extraordinary claims experience, actually would not be able to rely upon the participation of the other entities to cover those kind of claims loss. And I noticed that Senator Shields has left. He's heard the discussion on self-insured in another committee, and I know that Senator Crowe has heard this issue before. What I would say is it's an extremely complex issue, and there is a high level of risk going into it, particularly given the kind of rate increases that we're presently looking at that gives even a greater level of uncertainty to what these folks would be potentially facing. So I will, since I understand Senator Duncan wants to move on, I'll leave my remarks at that, but I would be happy to provide additional technical information. And I do know that there has been some advice given suggesting if someone wants to try a self-insured plan that they start with dental or vision, where their costs are much more predictable and they develop some experience as opposed to going in and doing a medical program at this point.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate both of you being here. I think if this is a burning question, I'd prefer to move on. We're not doing a work session today, and you folks are close by if we need you again. Okay?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, I'd like to ask John Powell and Mike Dewey if you would join us up here, please.
Okay.
Yes, same bill.
Mm-hmm.
You could be brief and highlight your comments for us. We'd appreciate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. And my name is John Towell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, we're not the dog in this fight, so I want to say that right up front, since we do not insure this district. I do think, however, this bill raises a lengthy question that should be very carefully thought through before action is taken, and that is the link between self-insurance and what this bill requires. I think Mr. Bedley pointed out some of the problems very well with associations and how that works. If we would have opposed self-insurance for these entities, we would have opposed the bill last session, and we did not. The question here is, apparently this bill would allow the public body to demand the insurer keep data in a way that suits their individual purposes, which may be different from body to body. It may be different types of information. Some of that could even be proprietary. But when we insure an association or a group made up of groups, we do not collect the data based on each one of those independent groups. And that would be expensive to do because people go to treating physicians, we get claims in, and we would then have to have a way of sorting out each one of those, including dependents, and all kinds of situations. So if they want to mandate that cost into this association, it could be a considerable cost. So we don't keep all this data. I think we would share the kind of data that Mr. Dudley talked about, the data that we base our premiums on, and we do with the association. But again, we do not do it by individual. And the intent of this bill to get some information for one or six districts or so could bring about death spirals to certain kinds of association groups, as was pointed out. So we'd urge the committee not to pass the bill, particularly in this form.
Thank you very much, Mr. Farrell.
Thank you, Senator Duncan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mike Dewey, representing ODS Health Plan. We do, to a degree, have a dog in this fight, but we could go either way in the sense of self-insurance on the dental side, and we do provide the dental coverage under the OEA program. I had contacted the expert at ODS and asked him about this bill because I thought it was fairly innocuous until they spent some 40 minutes with me describing the dilemmas and the problems and the computer work that would have to be done. And it does run counter also to the small group program. The idea is to bring in everybody into that and not to have exclusions, not to exclude pre-existing conditions and so forth. And this is almost the same analogy where at some point in time, because we have the data, we're going to get out and we're going to leave the bad risks, if you will, or the bad districts by themselves. Their rates obviously go up. That's good for perhaps this school district over here, not necessarily for this school district over here. And then if claims don't work out too well, they want to come back in, and that makes it pretty volatile in terms of the marketplace. So we think the program actually works pretty well for the benefit of the entirety as opposed to one or two districts. So we think you need to look at this very carefully. And we would agree if you want to move it, the language needs to be retooled significantly.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark. Again,
thank you.
Any burning questions? Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1001 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1035. The players are pretty much the same. Scott, did you want to? Scott and Stephen, do you want to come up together? Marjorie, why don't you brief us on things?
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, again, Senate Bill 1035 is brought forward by on behalf of the Ben Lapine School District. It's kind of similar to 1001. And that this creates a self-insurance public body fund using $500,000 of government money. And again, it requires that any insurers, group health insurers that insure the public body will provide information to that public body at their request.
Okay, Scott and Stephen, I'll let you guys go ahead. You kind of, again, with kind of highlight things for us today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I don't know, I apologize, I'm not polished at this. I don't know if I reintroduced myself, but my name is
you
Stephen
do,
Heron.
Yeah, we do need to have you do for the record here. Right.
My name is Stephen Heron, and I am a staff attorney with the Crook Deschutes Education Service District in Redmond, Oregon. As was noted, Mr. Chairman, one section of this bill relates to the disclosure of claims experience data, and that's already been discussed. And I'm not going to address that facet of it because those are the same arguments that we've already dealt with. The second facet of this bill, and the one that is crucial, and I want to preface this by saying that in our view, 1001 and 1035 really are requisite bills to the pragmatic or practical implementation of 867. We feel that 867 essentially becomes legislation without effect unless some of these other measures are taken. In relation to the self-insured public body fund, ORS 731-0366, which is the portion of the statute that details public bodies that can explore self-funded insurance and what the requirements of that are, requires that there be adequate reserves. And the difficulty is for a public entity, for example, a school district that is exploring self-insurance options, the difficulty of funding a reserve out of the gate is tremendous. As I'm sure this body is very aware, education dollars are being closely scrutinized. It is our perspective, and I think educators' perspective generally, that we are trying to do more with the dollars we have and stretch them and utilize them in ways to cover rising demands and needs on the education dollars. And the long and short of it is that trying to budget to set aside money under those circumstances to generate a reserve pool is simply difficult at best and impossible realistically. In a self-insurance program, the premiums collected at the beginning of the program implementation are being collected for future claims paid. There's no liability, of course, for past claims. So in the implementation of a self-funded insurance program, there is actually a cash infusion early on. And the difficulty is trying to implement it without, you can't implement it without the reserves in the first place. Once you're implemented, you're going to have a cash flow that will work towards generating a reserve. So this bill creates the self-insured public body fund, which for self-insurers in their startup period who have an extraordinary claim, the money would be, I guess I'm going to digress for another moment. I'm not entirely sure of what the process is involved in changing language in bills. I'm a neophyte to this process. But certainly comments in relation to reworking language is something that we would be interested in being a part of. The phrasing of this bill is that public bodies shall use the monies to create adequate reserves for self-insurance programs, but it could not be accessed unless there was an extraordinary claim. And so I think that needs some retooling, but I think what the intent is that public bodies shall use the monies to satisfy the adequate reserve requirements in the startup period. And I would submit that perhaps a two-year or a three-year startup period, if the fund were created, the existence of the fund and the fact that the self-insurer was in their startup period, they could access that fund, that would constitute an adequate reserve.
I understand that there's a $500,000 set aside the general fund as the startup fund. But
that's correct.
Put that in.
That's correct.
Okay, but so your information will take a ways and means, and ways and means action.
Okay.
Scott, do you want to get in here too in this discussion?
I've submitted my written testimony. It embellishes some of what Mr. Heron has told you, but I'm going to let you read that and see how the support of what I said really addresses his testimony, and I won't take any further time.
Okay, I think we have it on the record, at least for the public hearing now, and that way, if there is interest, we can continue it, if there's interest in the committee. If we get it on the record, we meet the deadline, and that's done.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Appreciate you coming over. It's a long trip for a short time, I realize that.
Thank you for allowing us to address the committee.
Do that. Okay. Peggy. And, I guess just Peggy on this one. Peggy and it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Peggy Annett, and I'm representing the League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties on this. The discussion of the establishment of this reserve fund is a rather interesting one, in that existing statutes already require reserves and reinsurance to take care of the extraordinary claims costs and such, and you can buy insurance coverage for that at certain levels. What this does is go beyond those kinds of traditional self-insured reserving requirements that the self-insured public bodies that independently self-insured now must comply with, as well as MIWAs. The thing that this does that is beyond that is actually create a cash flow fund to cover the initial cost. And I would say, from my personal viewpoint, that is very much beyond what one would normally consider to be contemplated as part of setting up, I'm trying to think of a faster way of saying it actually, but to set up a special fund to cover the cash flow issues even above those other prudent kind of reserving requirements you have to comply with. If this comes back for further consideration, I would be happy to elaborate on what the other reserving requirements are and what kind of risks already must be covered.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Peggy. Any questions? Okay, Bruce, John, and Mark, why don't you come join us?
Mr. Chair, and
yes,
order.
Yes, good
for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop representing Kaiser Permanente. We are here in opposition to Senate Bill 1035,
mm-hmm.
as it's presented to you. First of all, I want to mention why I did not sign up to testify on the previous bill that you've heard in this general subject area. Senate Bill 1001, as drafted, does not apply to HMOs like Kaiser Permanente or the healthcare service contractors. So we read the bill as not being applicable to us, even though there was testimony suggesting that it may have been intended to. By its terms, it is not. Senate Bill 1035, on the other hand, is applicable to HMOs and healthcare service contractors, including Kaiser Permanente. And I just want to address some of the technical issues that I would urge the committee to consider in the event you decide to go into work session on this bill.
Right, if you just highlight those, so if we want to, we can go back to it in the area.
First of all, the bill defines public body in two different ways in sections of the bill. I think that those definitions will be confusing and misunderstood. Second, the bill requires carriers to disclose claims experience data upon request. In the first place, Kaiser Permanente, as you've heard on the previous bill, Kaiser Permanente does not collect claims experience data, so it could be requested, but we don't have it, and the production of it would be quite expensive to comply with this requirement. Secondly, as drafted, the bill doesn't say that the public body has to request its own claims experience data. Presumably, it could request it for any other public body that it was interested in, and I think it's clearly beyond what would be a reasonable request, but that's the way the language is drafted. Thirdly, I want to point out that under current law, school districts are not authorized to self-insure for medical care. This is an issue that has come up previously this session before the Senate Health and Human Services Committee in regard to a community college bill, where that committee took action to make clear that community colleges could self-insure for health, medical, and remedial services, but that is not the state of the current law for other school districts. And finally, I'd point out that there is no definition of what constitutes an extraordinary claim under this bill for which a district would be authorized to seek reimbursement from the fund. I gather that that's intended to be something that the insurance commissioner could define by rule, but I would submit that leaving that discretion to an administrative body is probably unwarranted and would urge that the committee more specifically describe what it is can be claimed from this fund. Obviously, one expensive birth could completely tap out a $500,000 fund, and so what we might well have is a race to the fund to see who could first tap out the fund and cover their expenses. I don't think that's good public policy, and for those reasons, I would urge the committee not to approve Senate Bill 1035.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Senator.
Chair, Bruce, do you know of any other instance where the state has set up a general fund funded fund to help somebody self-insure?
Mr. Chair, Senator Trill, no, I don't.
It's totally unprecedented.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, John Powell with Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. And Mr. Chairman, I will not repeat our concerns about the first paragraph of the bill that deals with claims information. And would only say in terms of the self-insurance side of the bill, since Bruce has done a scholarly job looking at every word, I will simply put my mandate hat on and remind the committee that the more fixed costs that insurers have to cover in health insurance, the more people who are seeking self-insurance in which those mandates do not apply.
Thank you, Mike Durick, for the record, ODS Health Plans. I agree with my colleagues, and since I have signed up on some additional bills, I will just basically say I agree and finish there.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1035. Open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 25. Senator Shields.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'm going to wait for people to join me.
That's okay with you?
Yep.
Now, I hope that all the horse and dog racing...
I have Helen and Jerry come up and be close by when we need to.
I'm hoping that all the horse and dog racing industry people don't leave before my sermon. I think it's appropriate that I work out that way.
Okay. We're now in... should I close the public hearing and go into the sermon?
No, I don't think we should do that. He's trying to get some points, I can see that. Across the United States right now, people are looking more and more to try to do a better job at the delivery of social services to poor, needy, all kinds of folks. This happened partly because of the Welfare Reform Act of 1996. Now, before I go any farther, I'm going to say I'm not going to do my testimony at all, but don't look at the bill, okay? Because I have replaced the bill with what are the -1 amendments. My reason for doing that is that there were some complications with the original bill. It would have had both the Speaker and the Senate President appointing some people to an interim study. There would have been some per diem costs and so on. And we made a decision together that the more expeditious way of doing this would be to have the Department of Human Resources convene a task force to study ways to strengthen partnerships between faith-based organizations and those organizations that have more traditionally delivered human services. And if that's clear enough, I won't say a whole lot more about it. You can see who gets appointed. In the -1 amendments, we tried to consider all religious organizations and consider all social service agencies and government and consumers. Like you said, you wanted to go as fast as you could, so I'll not say more unless you have questions and let Gary and Helen and Jerry have at it.
Okay. Gary, why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, members of the committee. I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Resources. I'm here to support the Senate Joint Resolution. I guess one of the first things I want to say to you is that the policies, I'm glad to see the policy statement expressed in line 3 of the -A amendments, or the -1 amendments. I'm happy to see that in the sense that we've been doing this kind of thing for the past couple of years, so it'd be nice to have it be an adopted policy of the Assembly itself. For the last 2 years, we've been in meetings with ecumenical ministries, with clergy, more specifically Bishop Rusty Kimsey, who is the Bishop of the Episcopal Church east of the mountains. And those conversations have been for now 2 years lengthy and serious about how social services and religious organizations can come together to deliver better services across populations that we jointly serve. And the important message from our standpoint as a social service agency is that we're not looking for a deep pocket, or in this sense, a deep collection plate to dip into, if you will. But we're
a lot of that, how much you get depends on the sermon.
But we're looking for those opportunities for us to deal with mutual clients, and we think there are some real opportunities here. So when Senator Shields brought forward this joint resolution, we welcomed it because we think it strengthens what the department really believes is an important step forward in looking for new partners. That, as the senator has said, that the bill describes a good cross-section of members for the task force, and it would place the responsibility for me on me to appoint those people, which we would do in consultation with various religious organizations, social service organizations, and others. And then having the group appointed, they would begin working, bring to you, to the interim committee, emergency board, in July, a report on how we think that linkages could best be made in the way that we can deliver services more efficiently and more effectively. So there's a good, actually the original bill, the original Senate Joint Resolution, has a pretty nice work plan outlined in it, and that's probably what we would use as the beginning point to start a work plan for this task force called for in the Joint Resolution. So I think it's an exciting opportunity, and I would like to see us move forward. The bill does call for us to be sure that we pay the expenses of the task force members and so on, and I'll rely on Senator Shields' input on the Ways and Means Subcommittee as we look at the administrative costs to the department to help me make sure we've got those kinds of things covered on the Ways and Means side. But we appreciate the chance to to come before you today and support this report.
Okay, thank you very much, Gary.
And particularly, we were wanting just to cover the expenses of people that came from the low-income communities and might not be able otherwise to...
So it's more of an advisory committee, as I recall, rather than a...
Yeah, right. I did want to say that I've never thrown away a sermon before, but in wanting to expedite this process this afternoon, I'm scrapping all of my testimony to move forward as quickly as possible. Do you have questions of either area?
Yes, Senator Lynn.
Okay, thank you very much. How much will it cost to study? Any numbers we have, where are the funding coming from possibly?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lim, we're talking about a marginal amount of money. As Senator Shields has pointed out, we would be reimbursing the travel expenses for those non-state or county officials. That would be members of the public that serve on the task force. And so it would be whatever per diem cost it would be. It would be a negligible amount. We're not talking about thousands of dollars, Senator Lynn.
On the Welfare Review Commission that exists, we have some people that are on welfare or TANF that come to those meetings, and the travel expenses is usually about $32 a time for those folks that come. And if there are only three of them come from that community, you're probably talking about less than $100 per meeting. The other thing that I should say, and I don't know how we're going to quite work with this, but I've been talking to some people from various foundations to try and find some funding as well to do this kind of interim study. In fact, I had a letter from a person related to the JCPenney Trust just yesterday. And, there are some people that are really very interested in the study of this issue because people within the faith community can often deliver services with a sense of commitment and expertise where they combine both the best of social science and their religious background to deliver those services very well.
Well, it would be interesting to note right now that I'm just thinking of the work that's done by Ecumenical Ministries and other faith kind of groups out there. If you could figure out the impact of the cost savings to the state right now because of their work, it would be overwhelming, I'm sure. So I think while we talk about there may be some cost in the long run, there could be some cost savings.
And Senator Lim, I should add, we've been doing this work for 2 years, so I have staff, I've made a commitment of my own staff to work with the religious organizations in this, and we will continue that commitment into the next time.
Okay, appreciate
it. My name is Kristen, and I don't want many folks to the floor to come on my list of questions.
Senator Lim is still smarting over a $240,
yeah.
$247 expenditure the other day that there was some question about. So, Senator Trump.
It sounds like a good idea. It does. I read an article a while back that indicated that Oregon had a very large number of unchurched people. And what I would like to see continue to happen is that we don't quit serving them if we focus on faith-based. We've got to reach out to them, and I don't know whether the faith-based organizations really do that.
One of the things that I would insist upon is that kind of outreach occur. The kind of relatively new thing that's happening at the national level is that the federal government has recognized how cost-effectively faith-based organizations work. And in fact, we've come up with our own acronym, which kind of scares a lot of us in Washington to become an acronym. We are called FBOs, faith-based organizations. And even Andrew Cuomo, Secretary of HUD, has reached out and tried to pull people into his operation from FBOs, but at the same time, I think that one of the reasons I wanted to get ahead of this was to make sure that this didn't become the sole purview of one particular element of the religious community, but kept it as broad based as possible.
Thank you very much, Gary, and
thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gary and Ellen, do you want to join us? Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
No, I'll leave it up to the
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Beaverly. I'm here today.
No, I think I'd rather have Ellen start.
Okay. No.
Go ahead, Jerry.
Well, usually she goes first, and she always complains because I go after her and say, I agree with Ellen, and then she gets out of it. I get out of it. I'm here today representing the Community Action Directors of Oregon, and I brought you one of our new brochures in case you forgot who we were. I've been involved with CAF agencies in Oregon since 1977. I actually started in Illinois back in 1970, so I've been around for a while in the state and that type of activities. All through our history, the churches and other religious organizations have been effective, efficient partners in our operations. And examples are homeless shelters, food banks, child care facilities, Head Start facilities, programs for seasonal migrant farm workers, all that kind of stuff. So the idea that you can hook up faith-based organizations and social services is a valid one. We know it works. And that's why we support this resolution and why we really like the -1 amendments, which brings DHR into the player. That's the best, most fertile ground to continue to expand this partnership for a number of reasons. One is they got the money. Secondly is that those linkages, as Gary said, are being worked out, but they're not there yet. And so he can work the task force under their auspices, let them direct it, then they get ownership in the product and the output. And so they're likely to carry it out and implement it rather than try to impose it someplace else. So with that, we support Dashboard
America. I appreciate the work that's been done to bring about this collaboration, because I know there were kind of different people going different ways, and I think you've really worked together to bring this amendment in good shape. Yes, Ellen.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I direct public policy for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, and we are an organization that includes 16 Christian denominations in the state, and those denominations have about 1,200 congregations across the state. We've always said that we believe in functional interaction, but institutional separation of church and state, and so I would say that our denominations and congregations, as well as Ecumenical Ministries itself, has had a long time commitment to partnership. And to the question about the unchurched, Senator Schroe, we often say that our commitment is to the wider parish. It is to the community. And as I reflect on some of the things with which we have been involved, and I'll just list a few of them, health clinics, whether it's WIC or a safety net. Churches in Oregon are the leading providers of space for child care and food pantries, respite care, student mentoring, latchkey, summer food programs, housing, alcohol and other drug treatment, socialization programs for people living with chronic and persistently mental illness or HIV. And one of the interesting things, I think, is meeting space for whether it's AA or NA, or I remember that when DHR had one of their meetings in Portland, it was at a religious institution, and that was at the Middleman Jewish Community Center. But we do know that we can do more, and we know that the need is growing because we have more people in poverty today than we did a few years ago. And so we are gratified by the interest of DHR. Certainly Gary Weeks has expressed their readiness to participate with religious organizations. And again, we see the purpose to really reach out to that wider parish. And so we do support the -1 amendment.
Well, thank you. Senator Sherrill?
I just want to say that it really is important to think about the unchurched, and then also a very wide clientele of those who are in need have a great many problems that we need to deal with. And those, for instance, who have AIDS need to be accepted by the religious leaders that are out there providing freedom. We shouldn't exclude them.
Well, Senator Charles and Ellen, I obviously bit biased. Senator Shields and I both have served on the board of directors of EMO, and I'm just thinking, as you were thinking of saying that and thinking of the list, I was just thinking of the number of programs, the
the care center for those with AIDS, all of those things. There's just so many, it just crosses so many things. I just said, think oftentimes what it would cost the state if EMO just dropped out tomorrow and those burdens had to be picked up by someone else. You do a fantastic job, and as I said, I'm a bit biased, and I'm not on the board now, and I just have the greatest respect. I think everyone ought to go visit those programs, and you'd walk away with a pretty good feeling of what's happening.
I agree.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
Just for the record. Just because they're receiving public money, will that threaten their ministry part where they could? And I know the difference between acknowledging God and trying to push your doctrine. Would it forbid them from giving God the glory or, you know, mentioning the Lord's name just because they had public funds in their program?
Mr. Chair and Senator Shannon, our programs reflect our commitment to God, and since we're Christian denominations, certainly to Jesus Christ. They are programs that reach out to what I would call the wider parish. Do not, that part of the program is not something that is part of our evangelistic efforts. But it reflects the message of social and economic justice, which is found in certainly in the prophets, and what we read in the gospel. And so it, I think I would suggest that it's an example.
You live it.
Well, the only difference is they gave to the poor and you give. This is taking from people so you can do good. And this is not allowing people to give. It's taking tax dollars. And the other thing is, I didn't mean evangelism. I just meant, you know, if there an AIDS person sick and saying, can you pray with me? Because there's public money, would you be forbidden to tell the workers now you can't pray because we're taking public money?
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, if indeed at our HIV Day Center someone sought that from us, we would be able to respond. And I would say that most of the programs that I have mentioned have some public dollars, although there's some of them that have none. And so we think of this as a partnership. And so what you have is you often have public dollars leveraging volunteer hours, and the plate was mentioned earlier, the passing of the plate. And so so you will see a strong commitment from the members, from foundations, and from the wider community.
And churches that you're talking about, because I know.
Just so it leverages and doesn't control.
Well, if this thing's like to control it, we can't.
One of the things that I might add to this whole discussion is that this whole thing is just an interim study to see where we can go from where we presently are. Because under the Welfare Reform Act of 1996, there are some new provisions that allow for an expansion of the cooperation between faith-based organizations, churches, parachurch organizations, and so on. An expansion of that cooperation over what has previously occurred. And there's more freedom on both sides.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, okay. I can just say one thing real quick. And maybe this is something that's taken to the Rotary or Kiwanis instead of the public.
Thank you very much. Close the public hearing.
Are you ready for the session?
We're going for the work session on Senate Joint Resolution 25.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Joint Resolution 25 to the floor on the 25th session.
No, Dash one amendments. Has been moved. Any objection? Hearing none. Okay. Now we have your motion to spend.
Well, where are you better?
Dash one.
Okay, Dash one's going to step now. I move SJM 3 as amended to the floor of the due pass on the Foundation 25, SJR 25.
As amended, all right. Senator Trove moves Senate Resolution 25 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Lynch.
Aye.
Senator Shannon. How am I going to vote? I don't understand. I have to vote for him.
Let continue.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
Senator
Shields.
Aye. Aye.
Okay, I'll vote aye.
Good deal. So the joint resolution 25 is amended. Will be sent to the new pass recommendation. Senator Shields, you'd like to chair it? Okay. Now, we have before us, we have three bills that are interrelated.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I do want to make note of all the people that came back in after church was over.
You're talking about Larry Campbell or
something? No, he's safe. He's safe. I know. I was watching.
Yes, yes. Yes. Fine to be safe. Okay. We have before us today Senate Bill 229, 943, and 1200. What I'd like to do, folks, is to have a quick briefing on each bill. And then I'm going to kind of open a joint public hearing on the three and may ask you all to come forward so we can ask you questions at that time, if that's okay. So I'm going to start with Senate Bill, the public hearing on Senate Bill 229. And I believe Senator Dirkler, thank you for coming by. Would you like to join us? And you have an amendment. I don't think that you've seen it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dean Dilfer. I'm Senator from District 16. We had some discussion about the amendment on Senate Bill 229, but I would point out to you, I think the concern that I have, certainly coming from the Salem area, is that I'd like to make sure that the state fair is a viable operation. And that is a concern, not just for me, but I think that when you look at all the money we spend, I just came out of a budget committee meeting, when you look at the dollars we're spending on incarcerating people and the post-supervision cost of $111 million, we don't spend much money on the kids that are successful. And for me, the state fair is a very viable operation for kids, because there's a lot of kids that go into the fair with their animals, and the FFA and 4-H are good programs, and I think that we ought to keep going as much as we can. So my interest in this bill was, how can we perhaps get more resources to the state fair? But when I look at the bill, and it's been pointed out to me that, unfortunately, this is a new tax, and as you know, a new tax can't start in the Senate. So in order for this to fly, they're going to have to go back over to the House and perhaps introduce over there if they want to proceed with it. So unfortunately, this bill is not legal in this body, so I'm not going to suggest we introduce it. But I did want to point out to you that we do need to try to find some way to, and certainly Salem is a beneficiary of the state fair, but I think there's an awful lot of kids around the state that are also. So that was my interest in the bill, Mr. Chairman, and unfortunately this is not going to fly, so I would just point that out to you, and you'll have to carry on from there.
Are you in the process of having it introduced in the House?
I just found out about 3 minutes ago, so this is something that certainly can be considered in the House, but it's, I think it has a long ways to go, I guess, at this stage in the session.
Senator Shields.
Senator Dirkler, I've heard people arguing both sides of the issue of whether the racing is essential to the state fair in terms of its financial viability. What are your feelings about that?
Well, I've asked that question, and frankly, what I have a program going where we have the state, the county, and the city setting up a task force or get a feasibility study of what do we want the state fair to be 5 years and 10 years from now. And whether the racing is important, I don't know until perhaps we get that study. My feeling is that the racing industry, primarily because of the lottery that we've introduced into the state, has really suffered, and that is not doing well throughout the state. It does, again, when you look at the racing industry, it does have about 3,000 people in the industry working that will be eliminated if the racing goes away, and that's a choice that perhaps we can make later on as we go along. But I think it is an industry that does provide jobs to a lot of people, and I'd hate to have it go away. Whether it's a viable, you have to sort of look at it as a market condition. If the market will support it, then I don't have a problem with it. I'm not really anxious to subsidize it, to be honest with you, which we seem to do each time. But in subsidizing it, we are able to keep those people employed, so there's a benefit to that. I think the study needs to be made. There are some, and you talk to people that say that the horse racing is going to go away, perhaps in Oregon. There are other states that it's a pretty viable operation yet, but I think that Oregon has not been that viable. I think they're trying to come back, whether they can do it or not. There is some talk that Portland Meadows may not last, and the same thing with the dog track. I think it is a tough industry to keep going the way it is. And I'm somewhat in favor of it if it can't survive on its own. I hate to keep putting money into it, but I think you have to also look at the advantages of doing that. So I think that's a close call. Whether it's going to be good in Salem, I don't know. I talked to the state conservative manager. He would like to keep racing going for at least maybe another year to see how it works out. He feels that perhaps the industry may change and that the Portland racing may not exist a year or two from now. And if that didn't happen, then they could have the state fair operate the races, and it would be a profitable business for the state fair. I think as long as there's a competition in Portland, because that's where the population center is, I don't know that Salem really is a viable operation for Salem. So there's some variables that you have to take a look at. I don't know that we can really tell you whether it should stay or not stay. One of the things I'm going to ask the study to look at is, can that property that's presently used for horse racing, can it be used for some other program that might be more viable? I think that's one of the questions we need to ask. But mm-hmm. That study is going to probably be 6 or 8 months away, so I couldn't really give you
a answer. I have a question. You're talking about the study, and I didn't. Is that someplace moving through right now?
I talked to John Yonkers. He's putting it together through DAS, and they've agreed to do the study, and the county and the city are both going to put dollars into that study. And my feeling is that most people in Salem look at the fairgrounds as being a state property. And even though the state only uses a short period of time each year, the city of Salem benefits mostly from that property. There's some 300 events a year out there, but the state fair only uses it maybe 2 or 3 weeks out of the year. So I think Salem has to come into the equation of supporting it and helping eliminate the deficit that we presently have on the state fair. And I think that we can do that if we can come up with some other programs. And racing may be one of them. I don't know. That's something we'll have to take a look at.
We had not had a chance to talk, and you said you found out about 3 minutes before you came in here. That was that the legislative council or to our...
No, it was some people that didn't really like the bill.
Oh.
Are you sure they're
correct? Are they correct, the senator?
They are correct, because it is a new tax, and we can't start a tax on this side.
It's just interesting that they give you the information 2 minutes before you get.
Well, I'm not sure they did it for that reason, but they obviously were waiting for me when I was getting ready to come in. So.
Well, okay. Is there anything, any other questions for Senator Marsh?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining us. We're in public here on Senate Bill 229 right now. Obviously, there is some question. Is there someone who would like to discuss this bill very briefly? Because what I'd like to do is get all of them before we quit this afternoon, at least get the official public hearing on the record. Good afternoon. It's like the State Fair Board is, excuse me, not the State Fair Board, the Racing Commission is represented at this point.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Barham. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Racing Commission. With me is Stephen Walters, who is Chair of the Commission, and Tom Towsley, who is a Commissioner.
On Senate Bill 229-1, our amendments after the last hearing, it also has on the second page, starting on line 9, the what we were calling the simultaneous surcharge, and now what that is seen as a tax and can't start here. We would be willing and I think recommend that we cut out that provision. If we need to put it in over on the House side, that would be fine. It would go from line 9 through line 17. And just eliminate that on page 2. And then if it gets moved out, that issue can be talked about over on the House and then go into a conference committee.
Is this on the dash 1?
Yes, it is on dash 1.
And it was line what?
Page 2, line 9 through 17.
Okay.
What, the bill would do with that deleted is only two things. Number one, it would give the commission the authority to either approve what we call breed-to-breed or class-to-class simulcasting, so that the greyhound track could only simulcast greyhounds, horse track could only simulcast horse racing, and that would be on a year-round basis, which is different than current statute where they have to be running live, or the commission could authorize simulcasting to commercial race meets, both classes, when they are running live, which is what we're doing at the present time. It gives the commission that flexibility, basically takes that issue out of the legislative pool for decision-making process and lets the commission address it on a policy issue.
So right now, if I interpret what you just said, the way it currently is, Portland Meadows can have, during the season when it's off-season, they can simulcast racing, and they can simulcast the horse racing
and
dog racing right now. Okay. But when their season starts in October,
when their season starts in October, they can run live and they can simulcast horse racing and greyhound.
Okay. And at Portland Meadows
and Multnomah Greyhound Park,
I'm at Multnomah Greyhound.
Okay. When they start live, they can simulcast horse racing and greyhound racing.
The three, okay.
Right. That is one alternative for the verbiage in section 2. I mean, that's down on, starting on line 15. And then drop down to 19 at B. That is either class of racing when you're running live. Okay. The one above that is the class to class. So they could simulcast year around that class of racing that they run live, which would be the greyhound track that simulcast greyhound, horse racing. That's one thing the bill would do. The second thing the bill would do in section 4, which would be line 20 of page 2, presently the commission authorizes off-track sites as part of the race meet licensee process. Okay, so off-track sites are approved through Portland Meadows or approved through Multnomah Greyhound Park license application. What this would do is allow the commission to actually license the off-track operation site. They would have to have a contract with a operating track in at least one operating track in Oregon in order to qualify for that license. It also says that the money wagered at an off-track site has to go through the tote system or the totalizator system or the computer system at a racetrack in Oregon. So it just gives us a little more authority over some of the off-track sites. Rather than hold the track responsible, we can hold the off-track.
I have a question. Mr. Walters, where do you live?
I live in Portland.
You are in Portland. Okay. Because I do want to move and get through all three today, and I don't... Is there something you... Because I can bring
Tom and Steve Factory. Is there something you'd like to say at this time to save you a trip back?
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. This is a matter that's very important to the Racing Commission. I've been on the Racing Commission since 1991, and we have struggled through the issues related to simulcasting during that time and have met frequently with all the people in the industry you're going to hear from in connection with all of these bills. We think that this 229.1 is critically important to our industry to allow the Racing Commission to have the flexibility and the authority to regulate what is an evolving business, an evolving industry, and to apply the expertise we have gathered over the years I've been on the Commission and the years that Commissioner Townsley has been on the Commission. I'm certainly willing to come back also to testify on this because it's a matter of considerable importance to the race.
Okay, I think if that's okay with you folks now, there are a couple of other people here that want to testify, and then we'll move on to the others. I will get all three of them.
Thank you.
Thank you. John McCulley and Alan Lifton, the Oregon Fair Association. And again, if you can highlight things for us today, then we're going to we'll be back in the work session later.
I understand, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate that.
I'm John McCulley, representing the Oregon Fair Association, and Alan Westhoff is with me. He is with the Josephine County Fair, chairs our racing committee, and is going to answer all the questions that I obviously won't be able to answer. I'm going to talk about, if I might, Mr. Chair, the bill that has been introduced at our request, if that's how we want to proceed here. That is Senate Bill 1200.
Well, no, let's go 229 right now, then I'm just, you could hit that one. Anything on 229?
Mr. Chair, I will talk about Senate Bill 229.
Okay.
As you see, the Dash 1 amendment with the, as I understand, the change that is going to be necessary there, the major impact of this bill would be to, I think, eliminate racing at a lot of, at the county fair, the small racing. And that is our, of course, primary interest, because the folks that we represent do operate those race meets in the small communities in the state and at the Oregon State Fair. And as I think we had testified earlier before this committee when you had your general overview and Senate Bill 229 was on the agenda, the events that we're talking about at the Tillamook County Fair, at the Crooked River Roundup in Pineville, at the Harney County Fair in Burns, at the Eastern Oregon Livestock Show and Union, and at Josephine County, are community events. The racing is important, but it brings a lot of folks into the community. It fills hotel, motel rooms. It fills restaurants. It's a significant economic impact on those small rural communities. We're concerned that as Senate Bill...
Excuse me, I'm going to... Sure. Uh-oh, I have a full committee. Okay, go ahead.
We're concerned that Senate Bill 229, as it would be amended, would eliminate those race meets because they do not have access to being able to simulcast. And without some form of assistance, would not be able to operate.
Okay. Do you mind if I move on?
Not at all.
Okay. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, my name for the record, my name is Alan Westhoff. I manage the Josephine County Fair and Grants Pass. I would just like to reiterate most of what John has said, Mr. McCulley has said, in regard that herein lies the problem. Without our ability to share in the simulcasting share of the dollars, the live handle has gone from $100 million live in the last 10 years to $25 million live, and it's all we can live on is the live. It's all switched to the simulcast. If we don't have the ability to, in some way, shape, or form, share in the simulcast dollars, the five county fair race meets and the state fair race meet will be history, and this will be our last year. And that's just being as point blunt as we can be.
Okay. Well, we'll bring you back with 1200.
Okay.
Tom, you see it?
Mr. Chairman,
you bet. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. As always, it's an honor to be here today. Thank you so much for having me.
Good to have you here.
Senator Duncan,
mm-hmm.
Senators, very good to be here. I just have a letter here from Carrie Teal.
I'm going to read for him in his case because he couldn't be here today.
Could you highlight the letter and then just highlight it.
Carrie Keel, Lloyd Marbet, and Greg Kafuri. Lloyd Marbet was stopped at Oregon's gambling addiction. Dear Senator Duncan, committee members, over the last few years, we have seen many ways that gambling is affecting our community and our families. It is time for the state to retake control of this habit which has addicted both our citizens and our state itself. In light of this challenge, we are faced with limitations like those in ORS 6462.710 are necessary, perhaps more than any other time. No good reason exists for increasing the number of simulcasting operations in the state, allowing a new gambling resource for every video poker bar that needs to supplement its income. This bill is a carte blanche for the Oregon Racing Commission to expand gambling to the max. It gives them complete control of simulcasting from start to finish, including allowing them to redistribute the proceeds among racers any way they choose. The state of Oregon should not be in the business of promoting gambling. The job of the state should be to protect our citizens, not to prey on them. If we're going to lift the limit on simulcasting operations operating at any one time in Oregon, which is now 20, why stop there? Why not also lift the limit of 5 video poker machines at bars and taverns? Why not institute state-run casinos? The answer is no, because it is time to look this addiction in the eye and think about what is best for our families. Every addiction is a tragedy. Please vote no on Senate Bill 229. I also like to point out that today, Senate Bill 5533 did pass, and Senate Bill 5533 did give the Oregon Racing Commission its $3.5 million that it got about that, roughly that amount last session. And if this bill does go through, we would need to go ahead and go through the House and Senate all over again to reallocate funds, because it's going to be quite a nightmare for the legislature, so I wanted to just point that out. Well, thank you for hearing
me. Thank you very much. And are we giving the same testimony on 1200 and 943?
I have some other testimonies, not quite as lengthy, but I'll make it a little more brief.
So try to insert them all at the same time. Okay. Dave Nelson and Larry Campbell.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, sir.
Nice to have you folks with us.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson, representing Portland Meadows, and I also am probably the only breeder and trainer of racehorses in the room, and probably the only individual in the room who has raced a horse at almost every race meet in the state of Oregon, including Portland Meadows, the State Fair, Grant Pass, Tillamook, and Trainville. I haven't been at Harney County or Union. We're the opponents, the loyal opposition to Senate Bill 229, Mr. Chairman, and for basically the reasons that we described to you when we were here before speaking to 229 and the other bill that permitted greyhound racing at the state fair. And that is that the competition, the predatory competition on racing from state-sponsored video gaming, which in turn grew video slot machines at the Indian casinos, has essentially cannibalized the revenue at the racetracks to the point where, and as you recall, in 1995, we asked you to support, and we negotiated with Mr. Weeks, who was here before the committee earlier, who was then the head of the lottery, to allow each of MGP and Portland Meadows to have 75 video poker machines, which was then vetoed by the governor, and then another legislative fix in 1997 that was before you that many of you supported, that was again vetoed by the governor on the grounds that public money shouldn't be spent for racing. And as Senator Durfler said to you again earlier in regard to this bill, that he's not sure where racing is going. Well, let me tell you, Mr. Chairman, if you just eliminate the term racing, and if you think about the good of the state of Oregon, and if you say, okay, if we spent $2 million a year and created $140 million a year in economic activity that provided jobs for 3,000 people, would that be a good buy? I think most of you would say that probably would be a good buy. But then you put racing up on the marquee, and everybody kind of backs away because of a perceived senior side of life in racing. But basically, it's good business, non-polluting business. It's good employment for the people involved, and it's good entertainment value, as was determined in the governor's task force on gaming. I would say, in regard to Senate Bill 229, we looked at Senate Bill 229, and frankly, I was the one, Mr. Campbell and I were the ones who pointed out to Senator Durfler that this is a tax that cannot be started according to the rules of the Senate and the House in this body. And frankly, I was totally unaware that Senator Durfler had been asked to come down by the state fair to support a tax on Portland Meadows. And I think that Senator Durfler may be somewhat apprehensive about supporting that now. In any event, Mr. Chairman, just to very quickly state, and then Mr. Campbell will talk more about the status of racing. It's kind of like rearranging or trying to, we've come to the point of having failed twice to provide financial stability for racing, that now racing is trying to cannibalize itself, whereby you have some of the fair operators in the summer looking at taking revenue from Portland Meadows and from MGP and transferring it through the tax to those summer racing operations. We have nothing against or don't want to appear to have anything against those race meets. I participate there. I love them. I need them. I want them. All of that. At the same time, Portland Meadows has been compressed in its revenue down to the point where the 1.25% tax is greater than its bottom line. So with that gross receipts tax, then we go away. That's just simply the bottom line. So we would be opposed to Senate Bill 229 with the tax. I'm rather uncertain as to where, and we'll talk about this in Senate Bill 943, about the rest of the bill as well.
You know, I think for procedural kinds of things, I'm looking at the time. I want to get three bills on the record, the public hearing, so I'm going to do some rapid movement here at this particular point. I'm going to close the public hearing on 229. I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 943. And Mr. Campbell, I'm going to let yours move into 943. For those of you who are excited for the others, we'll get to you somehow or other, maybe not all of today, but I'll get the three of them on the record today. If you would continue on.
Well, Senator Duncan, members of the committee, and actually my testimony is background testimony that I feel is important as you make a key decision regarding the racing
right.
industry. And I think that Mr. Nelson is accurate in saying we are basically in support of the racing industry. And it was interesting to me as I went through, and I'd like to ask you to turn to page 3 in my testimony, and it's naturally behind page 4 because I put this package together myself. And page 3, right behind page 3, there's a colored graph for you folks to take a look at. I just want again to mention the fact that the increase that we've had from 1995 to 1997 in video poker machines has gone from 7,451 to 2,302. At the same time, if you'll look at the graph, you'll see where the parimutuel wagering in Oregon has gone from 120 million to 99 million. This is the crux of the problem that you're dealing with all three of these bills. As Dave says, the pie is getting smaller. And what it's done is it's turned supporters and colleagues of the racing industry into piranhas. And in essence, what we're all looking at basically is survival. I was interested because we put a package together which we were prepared to present to the legislature, and the governor has indicated that it is veto material. In essence, what we would have asked for is 27% of the profit from the video machines that just exist in the off-track betting sites. If those dollars could have been available to us, if you'll look at the last page, which is full of figures, you'll see where we could have provided money for Grants Pass. By the way, Grants Pass runs 20 days a year. Union, which they mentioned, runs 3 days a year. Crineville runs 4 days a year. Tillamook runs 3 days a year. Lone Oak Meet, the Salem Meet, runs 25 days a year. And Harney County runs 3 days a year. And you'll notice that we had put in $2.6 million for the purpose of funding those races. As I was reviewing the revenues that we're obtaining from wagering, it was interesting to me to note that the live track wagering in 1995-96 for these locations, county fair locations, was $4.2 million. But in 97-98, that dropped to $2.1 million, which is less than we had in to run those meets. Dave mentioned that is it a good business decision to keep those races going? We need them from a horse standpoint because they provide opportunity for our horses. But if you talk to anybody in the horse racing industry, you'll also note that the most important racetrack for them is Portland Meadows, and it's because of the length of time it runs and the quality of horses that run there. So basically what we're saying is that we understand why these folks are interested in obtaining dollars. But if you pass any of these bills that take dollars away from Portland Meadows, you actually put Portland Meadows in a position where it cannot exist. Now, there are folks who say that Portland Meadows is not going to exist anyway. I would like to hope that those folks are not interested in putting themselves in a better position to be successful with their bills because, you see, Portland Meadows has a lease in perpetuity. The idea behind Portland Meadows and the reason why we're interested in 943 is because it would guarantee Portland Meadows exactly what they've had for the last few years as far as product is concerned. If they had that product guaranteed, they could borrow money, and one of the things they would like to do is tear that facility down and put a facility up for about 3,000 people. Some of you have been to Portland Meadows, you know that it's based for about 10,000 folks now. You never get more than a couple thousand, 2,500 folks there, and they could really put a first-class operation in there for 3,000 folks. Another problem that they have, not Portland Meadows, and I may be off a little on my figures, but it's costing them about $28,000 a month for electrical and heat. And that's something else that would be corrected. Dave is right. Any of the proposals that you've heard so far that you will hear regarding this that takes money away from Portland Meadows will put them below their presence. In other words, the net that they have couldn't carry the expense. So that's the reason that we've come forward with 943. We believe that Portland Meadows should be given an opportunity to reconstruct. They will be able to continue with their lease there. And the way 943 is written is if the license isn't given to them, there's no problem. Then it goes away. But at least Portland Meadows is prepared to compete with its existing dollars and its existing product.
Sure. Well, thank you very much, Larry. I appreciate that. I'm going to close the public hearing on 943 at this point, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1200. And I think the only one I've not had a chance to hear from is, well, I'm going to have Mike and Brad. Mike and Brad, you've not had a chance to make any comments today. Yeah. I realize it's your bill, John, but... I'll just give you a couple of minutes here.
Thank you. Well, thank you. For the record, Mike Dewey and Brad Higgy.
If you just brief, be extremely brief.
What I wanted to do is, this is more of information than anything else, because you're not going to get into the technical nature of the various bills. What we've tried to provide you is, and have provided, is the typical calendar of the racing season, and to a degree, this explains the problem that we have, notwithstanding the video lottery and the casinos. And we want to thank the legislature for the previous help. Unfortunately, as you know, we didn't get all the way through the process. Some of you may be happy about that. Others, well, not so, but nonetheless, the facts are, Senator Schroeder is grinning over there. And quite frankly, we are not here for a package or a handout, if you will, a mitigation fund. We do call to your attention House Bill 3425 that hopefully will come to you in the near term, which will use racing revenues to help the Oregon racing industry if the internet or the totalizator hub is located. Mr. Campbell and Mr. Nelson adequately explained what has happened to the handle If you look at 94-95, down at the bottom, $120 million to 97-98, $99 million. Notwithstanding the increase in total races, if you look at the total races, simulcast of 40,000 and in total live and simulcast 42,000. If you look at that, compare that to the 17,000 in 94-95, clearly having additional simulcasting is not going to help us. That's not going to help us. So what we will be doing is dividing up dollars amongst ourselves, and if this trend continues, fewer dollars. So a tax on simulcasting in some ways robs Peter to pay Paul if there is a contribution from one side to the other side. So that's something I think is very significant. Mr. McFadden, who owns Multnomah Greyhound Park, is in the process of expending about $4 million on infrastructure improvements, recognizing that if we're going to compete, we have to upgrade the facilities, and he's going to do that. He's willing to do that. He signed the check to do that. He believes he can compete, so long as the proverbial field is level. The other dilemma is if you look at the calendar, and part of the problem is, and this is historic, Portland Meadows runs from October to April, about 6.5 months. Multnomah Greyhound Park, from May to October, about 5.5 months, and then you have Grants Pass, the State Fair, and the other county fairs that race within the summer. And the dilemma the Racing Commission has had is if you give everybody simulcasting, Portland Meadows has it basically the monopoly for 6.5 months, and it's great that they have it. That's historic. We would have it for 5.5 months, and then we would be dividing the pie with some other folks. So the Racing Commission has had a very difficult time trying to put all of this together. They are in a difficult position. We have supported the commission because we think that they have the tools to deal with it, notwithstanding the fact that there are some negative things happening out there. But I did want to point out that part of the problem is that the pie is getting smaller and the season doesn't work very well, particularly for us in the county fair race meets if you talk about simulcasting. That's why you might need to take a look at deregulating the industry at some point in time. We race when we want to race. Horses race when they want to race. It's not easy. Hopefully, we're not going to be arguing amongst ourselves. That's the last thing that can happen to us, or should happen to us, in these proceedings. And I put Mr. Shields to sleep, and I apologize.
I've heard so many times.
Brad. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Brad Higby, you said you wanted to go to 8 o'clock tonight? Oh, okay. Well, I'll just do it. Mr. Dewey said essentially...
You're welcome to go at 8 o'clock right after I adjourn the meeting.
All right. Thank you. I can come back. Thank you. Appreciate that. I usually get that kind of treatment in this place. That's consistent. I just wanted to reiterate the point that Mr. Dewey and Mr. Campbell both have made about the situation of a total handle. That's not money made. That's a total amount of money wagered. 94-95, the high water mark for racing, $120 million. The only tools available to racing have been to show live races and to import simulcast signals. And you saw 17,800 races to do that, to get to $120 million. The only tools over the last couple of years still left to us have been simulcasting and live racing. We've been milking that puppy, so to speak, as much as we can. 42,000 total races, 97-98 fiscal year, and handle dropped $21 million. Simulcasting is a very interesting solution for racing, but it's getting us much less, much faster than we hoped. These are very difficult situations. There aren't any easy answers. The Racing Commission is to be credited for trying to look at the entire industry. You get to hear from the industry segments here saying, do something to him or do something to her. That's a better way to go. Leave us alone. We want to make sure that the entire racing industry in Oregon can survive from the Little County Fair meet to the State Fair to Portal Meadows to Multnomah Greyhound Park.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Brad.
As I look at this, it looks like my wheat growers and potato producers.
The subcommission. Okay. I'm going to move back and give John and Ellen another shot since this is their bill.
Mr. Chair, John McCulley, Oregon Parents Association, we appreciate that and understand the time constraints, so we'll just do the Reader's Digest version here. Senate Bill 1200 that was introduced at our request is, as I guess Mr. Dewey was saying, the deregulation bill. It is a free market approach to the racing industry. It, as much as we believe possible, puts everybody on that proverbial level playing field. From our standpoint, it gives the nonprofits fair meet some of the same benefits that the commercial race meets have had, and that is access to simulcasting. You heard Mr. Campbell talk about the decrease in the live handle, the same decrease in live handles that occurred at the commercial race meets. But the difference is the nonprofit meets have no access to simulcast to make up or partially make up the difference. Senate Bill 1200 provides that opportunity for the Oregon State Fair and for Josephine County to be licensed to simulcast race meets. And then from that simulcast money, share it with the other fair race meets and with county fairs throughout the state. We think that this approach of to the extent possible, getting the state of Oregon out from under the of conducting this racing business, if you will, and letting the free market decide winners and losers, that may be us as well, is the best approach. And that, in very general terms, is what Senate Bill 1200 does. There are other very specifics in the bill, but generally I just want to tell you that.
Okay. You know, committee members...
Maybe
the
I have some.
No, not questions.
No.
See how much time you have.
Well, I have to go at 5. I have a meeting.
Okay, and you're ready to...
Yeah. I'm thinking maybe the Lord's not blessing his get-rich-quick
team. We're just having a hearing tonight.
Yeah. I wonder if it's possible for all these high-priced lobbyists to get together and work out a compromise.
Right.
Or are they at loggerheads so much so that it's impossible?
In the next 3 or 4 days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, Senator Trow, as you've heard, these issues are very complex, and there have been discussions, and I have to give a lot of credit to the Racing Commission for facilitating discussions individually with all of us, trying to arrive at a solution. And I'm sure it's worthwhile to give it a try. The point that we seem to hear, both from the Racing Commission and other testimony and from other people who have testified today, that the small race meets can just go away. And we're concerned about that as a basic premise here. We like the positive words that we've heard that they're important, but when you get down to it, the bottom line is they're not really necessary because, as you heard in other testimony, somebody's got to make the decision who's going to survive and who's not. I don't know if there is a way to do it. We're more than happy to sit down with other folks and continue those discussions.
Well, as I'm hearing the concern, if I'm getting part of this right, now there is the concern about, obviously the concern about, yes, extremes. Those who want no gambling at all. And, you know, video poker and the whole works do with gambling. And I think there are some of my colleagues who would go along with that concept. And then, but if you make the decision that we have a racing industry, you have 3,000 jobs bringing into the economy, you have a horse industry, and if you want to keep that going, then how do you do it? And I guess that, and then there's also the commitment to the state and the county fairs. You've got that element to put together. And then there's the concern that the major, not year-round, but extensive racing, which is Portland Meadows. And you want it to falter, because if you falter it, if it falters, does the racing, horse racing industry fall apart in Oregon?
Yep.
Am I capturing the
problem.
The problem. I'm not going to deal with the answer right now because I can do much better with the problem. What else do we hear? What am I missing? if anybody from the other, from the different bills want to come forward on, and want to just add to that, I'd be happy to. Does the Fair Commission want to have a representative up at the table for a minute here?
But Senator,
I'm not going to keep everybody long, but I come on up, Dave, and sit up here, and I'll let one of you join them up here.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Alan Westhoff, again from Grants Pass. What Senate Bill 1200 does, lets us operate within the parameters of our own industry.
Let's look at I'm going to open it up also for any discussion so you can touch 229, 943, or 1200.
Joint hearing.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Dave Elson from Portland Meadows, and I just handed out a short testimony regarding Senate Bill 1200 from Portland Meadows as being the target of Senate Bill 1200. And I think if you just skip down to the little diagram that says before Senate Bill 1200 and then below it says after Senate Bill 1200. Before Senate Bill 1200, Portland Meadows has been authorized to conduct live racing, to simulcast horse races, and to simulcast dog races. Multnomah Greyhound Park has been authorized to conduct live dog racing, simulcast dog racing, and simulcast horse racing. The fairs have been our biggest problem in trying to finance. Last year, now they can, in the current biennium, the fairs have live horse racing and an appropriation from the emergency board that was approved in November.
And the comment I've heard from leadership, there will be no state money going into racing.
Mr. Chairman, you have relayed that to us, and I think that we're still hope reigneth eternal, and so we're still going to be talking to you when you ring the final gong. But you cannot, that's a policy decision that the state has willingly surrounded Portland Meadows and MGP and every other race meet in the state of Oregon to pluck its revenue away from it. And I think that it's very short-sighted to now say unequivocally, we're going to turn our back on those segments of racing. Anyway, go on down to the after Senate Bill 1200 column. Portland Meadows is left with only two of the three. That's live horse racing and simulcast horse racing only during its season. Multnomah Greyhound Park, however, has live dog racing, simulcast dog racing, and simulcast dog racing over the top of Portland Meadows all year round. The fairs then have live horse racing and summer simulcast horse racing, and Portland Meadows is one leg short of a three-legged stool.
Now, what's
the economic cost, Mr. Chairman, is we lose $14 million in handle from the 90s, roughly, which translates into about $2.6 to $2.8 million in gross revenue, of which we pay about $830,000 to horsemen in purses, and the remainder is operating revenue. So that's the net effect. Simply, straight away, raid on Portland Meadows Treasury that puts it in a position of not having enough to operate.
Then have to keep, because people are going to leave it in
the future. Suppose we just went to the status quo before 1200 in terms of who got to do what, in terms of Portland Meadows and Multnomah Greyhound Park, and we gave the fairs the simulcast horse racing along with the live horse racing, would that solve the problem?
Mr. Chairman, Steve Walters,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Steve Walters, the chair of the Racing Commission. As I said earlier, we have struggled with these issues. I've been on the commission since 1991. As was pointed out, we have met regularly with all aspects of the industry. We did it again coming into this legislative process when we got instructions from the executive office that we were to try to take a leadership role in the legislative process to resolve the simulcast issue. The problem with Senate Bill 1200 is that, as Mr. Nelson says, it will put Portland Meadows out of business in a second.
That will change the horse racing in Oregon dramatically to a situation where it is basically run by or operated by the state and county fairs at small fair-type facilities and have a dramatic effect on the breeding industry in Oregon and the horse racing industry in Oregon. With 943, the Portland Betters Bill, the problem with that bill is it locks into place a number of aspects and basically asks this the legislature to regulate the allocation of simulcast signals and benefits in a way that we think is most appropriate for the Racing Commission to do. It also leaves the summer portion of the situation of the equation that Mr. Dewey pointed out to you absolutely unchanged, and this is where the chaos is. Now in simulcast.
Is that 1 month?
It's the summer months where there is a tremendous overlap of
the county fairs,
of county fairs and Greyhound Park. The answer to Senator Tro's question is that if we let Portland Meadows keep exactly what it's had and then divide up summer horse simulcasting among all these people, Multnomah Greyhound Park will go out of business very quickly. So what the reason we have proposed 229 and the one in the form we proposed it was to ask you to give the Racing Commission the flexibility and the authority to resolve these problems and think in the way we think is most appropriate based on our years of experience and consulting with everyone. These are not easy choices. They are not easy decisions. And as Senator Shields pointed out, this industry has fallen on hard times. I personally think that horse racing and greyhound racing can survive in Oregon, but I think it's likely over the next several years there will be differences in the industry. But what we would ask the committee to do and the legislature to do is give the Racing Commission the flexibility and the authority to do its job.
Let me ask Chairman a question. Just a second, Dave, let me just say, any burning questions from members of the committee, right?
Except I'd like to hear from Rusty, the one that does the state share.
Okay, we'll have Rusty here in a minute, too. Anybody, any other questions from the committee? Okay, I'd really kind of like to finish. Let Dave finish.
One comment, yeah. Chairman. We understand that Mr. Walter's concern on Senate Bill 943 and that the Racing Commission would like to have the flexibility to do what they felt was right. And I think that I have attached to my testimony that you have before you a list of about 10 items that that in the Racing Commission's judgment over the last 10 years have resulted in a tax on Portland Meadows ranging from $300,000 to $400,000 a year. The Racing Commission took 2 weeks of racing opportunity away from the horse racing track and gave it to the dog track and on and on and on. And that's why we are very apprehensive about supporting that flexibility. It always seems to cost Portland Meadows.
One other person, just a second. I really slipped up. I let everybody... Rob Douglas, it's Rob Lee. I feel guilty. I just think I can get completely on this whole thing. Okay, I think we may want to hear from Rusty. If he's, yes.
There's one thing I can't let pass on that, though. The commission took two weeks away from Portland Meadows. However, what Mr. Nelson failed to tell you is Portland Meadows put in for a reduced number of live race dates. Under 80, in fact, I believe it was like 72 race dates fewer, or 72 race dates, which would be 8 fewer than what they did the year before, or thereabouts. At that point, the commission said, if you're not going to use all of these days, then you don't need all of the window. So you know, the full story is easy to know, too.
We'll come back. Rusty, comment.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rusty Byrne, Director of Oregon State Fair. As you can see, there's lots of opinions here. I think I'd like to say at least just a couple of things. When the simulcasting laws were passed by the legislature, it was not intended that that be the death and demise of the fair racing meets. It was intended to be a supplemental income. What happened was there was a great shift in the way people placed their bets. So you had a huge number going to simulcasting and a small number starting to occur with live racing. But what happened as a result of that was that the fair meets got unfairly punished. They were never allowed to go and compete in the market as it was currently being constructed. So I think it's a little bit disingenuous to say that it was the commercial meets money. It was racing's money, and the fairs were prohibited from participating in that market. So they've been a little bit on the punished side here. The 1200 bill, what it does do is say, let's get government out of this industry. If the industry is having diminishing resources, we shouldn't be trying to profit up. Let's let the industry work it out in its own market, and let's give everybody equal access to the market. If someone fails, then someone fails. It's probably better for the industry, and that could be me that fails. But let everybody have equal access to the market. Florida Meadows talks about 1200 and what it would do to them and what they would be prohibited from doing. What they fail to say is what they could do. And what they could do is a lot. They can replace every lost dog signal with a horse signal. They can, in fact, increase the number of days that they race. Take those days back that the Racing Commission took away. They have lots of different ways, without going into all the numbers and stuff, about increasing their revenue under that bill. It may, in fact, have some negative revenue consequence to them, but not this huge millions of dollars that they talk about, because they don't talk about what they can do. They would certainly have to work harder. But I think putting a regulatory commission in the position of determining the business strategies and operations of the business that they regulate is an appropriate action. And if, in fact, industries are failing, I don't know where it's driven, the government's job to sit there and save them. Let the market work it out. If it needs to condense and contract, let it contract. But give everybody equal access in the market. Don't punish the fairs. Just go out there and solve the problems if we can solve them. If you can't, then the strong will survive, and the industry will be stronger for the net result of that.
Just a second. Okay.
Free enterprise sounds like a novel idea.
Any other questions for us here? Okay, thank you. All right. Yes, come.
Thank you, Senator. Sure, Duncan, thank you very much for the honor of being here again. Just a couple of points I want to make, and that is the Multnomah Greyhound Park pays no state tax. And that is unheard of among businesses. They pay no state income tax at all, none at all. And they've come here time after time trying to get to different handouts. They started out with the, as far back as they were in 1996, the video poker machines. The governor vetoed that. They came back 28-7 trying to get $4.8 million handout. That was also vetoed. They came up with 228, which tried to get Broadway from the Oregon State Fair. Then they came up with 229 to increase the simulcasting site from the state. Then they came up with 3425. 3425 would have decreased the amount that the track, the dog track pays. They used to pay 3%, then they went down to 1.6. Trying to get it down to 1%. What's it going to be next year? We're paying them to stay in business? I mean, they pay no state tax. And this is just, to me, is just ludicrous what they're trying to get away with. Now they count this 1200, which let dogs, the dogs run all year long. This is just another form of handout is all it is. And not to mention the humane issue, which hasn't even mentioned here today, 1 million greyhounds have died in 74 years of dog racing. That is a fact. That is a simple fact. The track claims are a no-kill track, but it takes between 1,200 and 1,000 dogs to run the track. And Steve Barham himself admitted last time we were here during 228 and 229 that he has no authority over where those dogs go.
Ronnie, I think I'm going to hold it to, because okay. I don't think that's our...
I think I made my point, so yeah. Thank you very much, Senator. Okay. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much. All right. Obviously, there are some decisions that have been made. We're probably not in the position to do anything this evening, but at least we do have, we've had a public hearing on everything, so we can continue moving forward. Where that ends, I don't know at this point. I think at this point I'm closing the work session on the public hearing. Excuse me. I'm closing the public hearing on 1200. And then I also we sort of had everything going. I'm going to, to make it all legal, I'm going to close whatever I had on the discussions on the public hearing on 993, 9400, and 229. That's it. That's it. We're adjourned. That's it.